I'm Tobin Heath.
And I'm Kristen Press.
We're World Cup champions, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Week in and week out, we sit down with sports legends, cultural icons, and global changemakers to talk everything from clutch games to causes that matter.
This is about creating the future of women's sports, a future that's honest, inclusive, and real.
Join us for our reimagined journey. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
From the overwhelmed air raid shelters of Kyiv to the contested waters of the Persian Gulf, the global chessboard is becoming increasingly transactional and incredibly dangerous. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Kirvin. And this week, we are dissecting a world where narrative warfare is masking deadly realities. In Ukraine, a calculated campaign to cripple Russian logistics behind the lines is being met with a punitive, massive wave of ballistic retaliation designed to break the psychological resilience of the population. Meanwhile, Washington is utterly consumed by a fragile 60-day ceasefire framework with Iran. But as the U.S. supposedly lifts its blockade in exchange for an open Strait of Hormuz, competing realities and fundamentally opposing interpretations threaten to tear the deal apart before the ink is even dry. We are also tracking a fractured NATO, where Washington is openly treating its European security umbrella as a conditional bargaining chip. And in the Indo-Pacific, a sudden pause on a $14 billion arms sale to Taiwan suggests Beijing and Washington are playing a much longer, quieter game of geopolitical leverage. Are we witnessing the masterful de-escalation of multi-front conflicts, or simply the trading away of global stability for short-term political wins? Let's get into the state of play. We will start, as we do every week, with Ukraine. And I'm looking at these competing statements out of the Luhansk region. And it's just this massive collision of realities. Moscow is claiming Ukraine deliberately struck a student dorm, while Ukraine is saying, no, we hit the headquarters of an elite drone unit.
Right. And what we're looking at is classic narrative warfare here. And so you've got Putin publicly stating there wasn't a single military target anywhere near these strikes, which sets the stage for the retaliation that he is inevitably planning. But if we look at the actual mechanics of the broader battlefield, Ukraine is systematically targeting the exact drone infrastructure Russia is using against Ukrainian cities.
Which makes sense when you look at the other strikes this week. We're seeing oil depots hit on the Black Sea, security headquarters in Kherson, and Ukraine is clearly trying to degrade Russia's operational capacity behind the lines.
Yeah, they're going after logistics, command and control, and also going after the fuel depots there. Now, I will say the Kremlin desperately needs a domestic justification to escalate, or just to explain away why they're getting hit so deep in occupied territory. So claiming a civilian dorm was targeted does exactly what they want it to do.
And while these military and political chess games are happening, there are real civilian areas getting devastated, like that residential block in Kyiv.
Yeah, and it's usually what Russia does. And that ties directly into what we're seeing up north with Belarus right now. It's just another layer of Russia trying to stretch Ukrainian resources and manipulate the narrative to their advantage.
Right, because we've seen all this movement near the Belarusian border, joint nuclear drills, physical infrastructure being built. To a casual observer, it genuinely looks like they're setting up for another northern offensive toward Kyiv.
Yeah, I think that's entirely by design. But if you strip away the noise, it almost certainly looks like a diversion. The Belarusian military just doesn't have the combat experience or the equipment to pull off a successful invasion right now.
So what you're saying is that it's basically like a phantom threat, just Moscow trying to force Ukraine to pull its best battle-hardened troops away from the Eastern Front to guard the North?
Yeah, I think that's, in my mind, that's the primary objective. They want to replicate the panic of the initial invasion without actually committing the massive conventional forces that that's going to require. And it's working out. It's working to a degree, I'd say, because Kyiv has to take it seriously and Kyiv has to reinforce those supply lines.
I mean, you really can't ignore it if they're building forward artillery positions. But What about Lukashenko in all this? He's hosting Russian nukes on one hand, but then seemingly telling Ukraine he won't attack unless they attack him first. And then we see the other shoe to drop after that Ukrainian strike on Russia's headquarters or dorm or whatever it can be confirmed to be. Russia began its most massive volley of missiles since the war began.
Right. It's the retaliation that Putin promised. And it wasn't just political theater this time. We're talking about a massive coordinated ballistic and drone package hitting all across the capital of Kyiv. Residential blocks, schools, commercial warehouses. This is all purely a punitive strike.
Which is exactly what Moscow telegraphed they were going to do. They're still heavily pushing the claim that Ukraine deliberately targeted that student dorm in the occupied east. The death toll there is rising, and Russia claims it's mostly young women, which, if confirmed, would be heartbreaking. I mean, any loss of life is heartbreaking, but, you know, obviously targeting civilian infrastructure, people who don't want to be in this. Well, actually, I guess a lot of their soldiers don't want to be in this conflict either.
Yeah, that's but, coming know, out as well, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is just, you know, this is the grim reality of this phase of the conflict. Now, Ukraine still maintains that they hit Russian drone, this Russian drone unit that was stationed in that exact area. But Moscow took those civilian casualties. They weaponized the narrative and essentially used it as a blank check to hammer Kyiv's civilian infrastructure in response.
And people knew it was coming, too. You had Zelensky and the U.S. embassy practically shouting from the rooftops that a massive attack was imminent. There was even all this chatter about Russia pulling out that new hypersonic missile, the Oreshnik. I believe the Oreshnik.
No, you nailed it.
Ah, look at me go.
Yeah. Honestly, this is a terrifying signal for Russia to send to Ukraine, but also to all of Western Europe. And whether they actually used the Oreshnik in this specific wave or just saturated the airspace with standard ballistic missiles, the message lands exactly the same. Moscow is showing they can overwhelm Western air defenses whenever they feel provoked enough.
But didn't they confirm that they used the hypersonic missiles?
They're still back and forth on it. There was some video that came out where people said it looked like they were using the Oreshnik. There were also some that debunked some of those. So still looking into it. Still don't know it 100%.
Competing narratives like everything these days.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you see the chaotic result on the ground. People were taking shelter in the metro, and you've got a school where the air raid shelter entrance got blocked by debris with people trapped inside. I mean, it's just a complete terror for the civilians caught in the middle of this tit for tat.
Yeah, and it's a calculated terror. Look, when you hit dozens of locations simultaneously across any capital city, you aren't just going after military value. You're not going anywhere after military value. You're actively trying to break the psychological resilience of the population because you want the population to force the government to second guess their own deep strikes into occupied territory.
But does that actually work? Because it feels like this cycle of retaliation is just spinning faster and nobody is stepping in to hit the brakes. The diplomatic channels to end this seem completely stalled right now.
Yeah, I think they're worse than stalled. They're starved for oxygen. Look at where Washington's bandwidth is right now. The U.S. is completely consumed by managing the ongoing fallout in the Middle East. Moscow sees that.
So Russia basically sees a window where they can escalate the punishment without Washington breathing down their neck. And that's because if you look at Washington right now, nobody is going home for the holiday weekend. The president, the intelligence community, military officials, they are completely distracted. Everyone is just sitting by the phone, waiting to see if they can finally get this peace deal with Iran across the goal line.
Right. And the reality is the Middle East friction point is completely dictating the global chessboard right now. And when you look at these Iran negotiations, you have to look past the official press releases. Now, the real story is that leave is being canceled. Regional bases in the Middle East are tightening their recall windows. The president isn't going to go to a wedding of his own children. That tells you everything you need to know about the actual friction here. The posturing is over.
I was wondering if you were going to bring up old Donnie Jr.'s wedding, his nuptials.
My favorite excuse now to not have to go anywhere is I'm too much of a patriot. America needs me right now. I can't be going to your wedding.
That's not going to work with you being out of the country currently.
That's
but I guess you're helping American interests where you are. So,
maybe I'm even more patriotic.
Yeah, you are so patriotic. You're away from the motherland suffering so much, but you're there for America, for America. Good job. Okay, that's enough out of me. Okay.
All right.
Well, okay. Since, let's get back on course here. Since you want to suddenly change topics here, let's start from the beginning. We were bracing for military strikes all weekend. I don't know how many articles I sent you that said they were impending. And yep. I wondered if it meant you were going to lose another weekend having to go into the office. So, you know, beyond me texting you for your thoughts on the probability of renewed strikes, and you asked to pause today's recording or Sunday's recording to cut through the fog of the information space. And now we're suddenly hearing about a framework for a 60-day ceasefire.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the information space was getting whiplash. That includes you and myself, you know, going through all those articles and the reporting. And we would see U.S. President Trump. He would truth out one thing. That's what I'm calling truth social posts. I don't know if anybody else is doing that, but
instead of a tweet, he's truthing it out. He's truthouting, guys.
Let's truth out, guys. So he would truth out one thing, and then the Iranians would use their aptly named farce news agency to counter the president. Then through Sunday, when I asked to pause our recording, it finally looked like the diplomatic back channels actually produced at least an outline. By all accounts, what we are looking at is a phased de-escalation where the U.S. lifts the blockade on Iranian ports, and in exchange, Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz,
which immediately takes the pressure off the global energy markets. We're even hearing Washington say the strait will be completely open with zero transit tolls, which is important because obviously getting every ship to pay $2 million to cross the strait is crazy.
Yeah, that's not going to reduce oil prices, right? And as those tankers or oil tankers coming through. And look, this is the narrative coming out of the Trump administration. They're projecting confidence to counter Iran's confidence right now, but both sides are also carefully messaging, and they don't want to rush things here. But when you compare the reporting from different sides, there are some massive contradictions.
Right. That's exactly what caught my eye. You have Western officials claiming Iran is going to give up its highly enriched uranium, maybe even ship it to a third country like Russia. But then Iranian sources are flatly denying that.
Yeah, the messaging out of Tehran paints a totally different picture from the one coming from the United States. And senior Iranian officials are insisting the nuclear issue isn't even part of this preliminary agreement. They're also claiming they'll still maintain control over the Strait of Hormuz despite Washington's statements.
So we have two completely different realities being broadcast right now. So that's pretty much par for the course. They kind of throw two different narratives at each other, and we're left to pick through and decide which side we fall on, which side of the fence are we on. So how does a ceasefire actually hold if both sides fundamentally disagree on what they just negotiated?
And yeah, that's a great question. And everyone who listens to this podcast understands this happens more often than the masses really would realize. Both sides need a win for their domestic audiences. And Washington gets to claim they secured the waterway and contained the nuclear threat, while Tehran gets to sell oil again and tell its people they didn't surrender their sovereignty.
I mean, that makes sense as a short-term political strategy, but eventually the actual terms have to be enforced. If Iran refuses to hand over the uranium, doesn't this whole thing just collapse?
Yeah, for sure. You're absolutely right. And this isn't lasting peace. This is an extension of the already agreed upon ceasefire. That's why this 60-day window is so critical. It's just a pause to get the oil flowing again while they try to hammer out the hardest parts of the deal.
And if they can't bridge that gap, we're right back to the brink of military strikes, which brings up the broader regional picture, because this isn't just happening in a vacuum. You still have the situation in Lebanon completely entangled in all of this.
Yeah, and that entanglement is very intentional on Tehran's part. So if you look at Iran's latest counterproposal, they explicitly demand an end to the war on all fronts. They're actively trying any movement, or they're actively tying any movement on the Strait of Hormuz to Israel halting its military campaign in southern Lebanon.
But wait, aren't Israel and Lebanon running their own separate diplomatic tracks right now? I mean, we just saw them agree to a 45-day extension of their own ceasefire after those talks in Washington.
They are, and look, this is an historic moment. You have Israelis and Lebanese officials engaging in direct negotiations for the first time in decades. But Hezbollah isn't a signatory to that agreement. And they're the ones actually holding the weapons.
Which makes you wonder how much authority the Lebanese government actually has to enforce anything on the ground. Beirut desperately wants the IDF to withdraw, but Israel isn't going to pull back unless Hezbollah disarms, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Hezbollah's leadership just came out and said that voluntary disarmament is a hard red line for them. They're even continuing to use first-person view or the FPV drones against Israeli forces in the south, despite this extended truce supposedly being in effect.
So what you're saying is that we essentially have Washington and Israel trying to keep the Lebanon conflict in its own isolated box, while Tehran is doing everything it can to force it into the broader U.S.-Iran negotiations.
Yeah, because Iran genuinely believes it's winning right now. The intelligence assessments coming out indicate Tehran feels they're negotiating from a position of real strength here. They want to use their leverage over global shipping to force a regional security reset that protects their proxies.
And while they play this massive game of geopolitical leverage, you have Lebanese civilians totally caught in the middle. I was looking at the recent numbers, and hostilities in the south have actually doubled since the initial ceasefire was even announced.
Yeah, which is why everyone in the defense base is looking at this upcoming military coordination between this military coordination meeting at the Pentagon. You're going to have the U.S., Israel, and Lebanese defense delegations trying to figure out an actual enforcement mechanism for southern Lebanon. That is why the back channeling is the only thing keeping the region stable right now. All this weight is actually sitting squarely on Pakistan's shoulders as the intermediary passing these final offers back and forth.
Yeah, and I think what gets lost in the weeds with these Iran negotiations is how much of a ripple effect it's having on other alliances. Because the United States is so frustrated that European partners aren't backing them up in the Middle East, they're starting to use troop deployments as a bargaining chip, and they're doing it at the absolute worst possible time for Eastern Europe. I mean, look at what just happened in Lithuania this week. Drones begin to fly overhead with kids on their way to school, and suddenly the air traffic stops, emergency protocols kick in, and those kids are being moved into shelters.
Yeah, the psychological impact here is massive. The situation in Ukraine stops being a war a few borders away and suddenly becomes a very real, very immediate threat right in your own backyard.
And the crazy part is we still don't even know for sure whose drone it was. I mean, the thing just vanished off the radar.
Right, and that leaves us looking at two main scenarios here. Either it was a Ukrainian drone that was hijacked by Russian electronic warfare and drifted off course, or it was a deliberate Russian probe.
Like testing the fences? Like seeing how quickly NATO scrambles jets and reacts?
That's absolutely right. And honestly, as we often say here, the intent almost doesn't matter as much as the outcome. It proves how easily the conflict can spill over the borders, accidentally or otherwise. Now, the Baltic states have been warning about this exact kind of hybrid threat since the war in Ukraine started.
And that is what makes the timing of everything happening with the U.S. right now feel so much more volatile. You've got this heightened physical threat on NATO's eastern flank, and at the exact same time, Washington is sending completely mixed signals about its troop commitments.
Right, like we had the sudden decision to pull 5,000 forces out of Germany. Then a planned troop deployment to Poland was canceled, followed by the abrupt pivot to then send troops to Poland. It's definitely not the steady, predictable posture that an alliance relies on for deterrence.
And then you've got Secretary of State Rubio over in Sweden doing major damage control. He's trying to reassure everyone that things are coordinated, but you can feel the underlying tension. It just feels very transactional right now.
Yeah, and the tension is structural at this point. The U.S. administration is clearly tying European security to other global issues because NATO allies weren't backing Washington in the conflict with Iran. The United States is essentially saying, we're going to rethink our footprint here in Europe.
So it's basically, if you don't support us in the Middle East, we might just pack up our security umbrella in Europe.
Yeah, and European leaders are reading the writing on the wall right now. Mark Rutte said, the quiet part out loud, Europe's trajectory toward being less reliant on the U.S. is just going to continue. They're realizing the era of guaranteed, unconditional American backing is shifting.
And that puts places like Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia in such a tough spot. They're practically begging for stronger air defenses because of incidents exactly like this drone. But the biggest guy in their corner is openly looking toward the exit.
Yeah, and when you map this out, the strategic picture actually is pretty stark. If we assume the U.S. continues to pull back or even just hesitates, which is the most likely scenario right now, is that hesitation, Europe is forced to aggressively scale up its own defense manufacturing. But that takes years. So in the short term, you've got this dangerous vulnerability gap right over the Baltics,
which makes those border countries feel incredibly exposed while the rest of Europe tries to catch up. And honestly, that has to be emboldening for Moscow.
It is, and it's not just about a single stray drone or a messy troop rotation in Poland. It's about perception. When the U.S. treats its security umbrella as highly conditional, adversaries don't see a strategic pivot. They see a fractured alliance. They see a window to test boundaries without triggering a unified, overwhelming response.
Right, because if we're arguing internally over who pays for what or who backed who in the Middle East, we aren't presenting a solid front. We're distracted.
And you better believe that division is being monitored very, very closely. The fragmentation of Western security isn't just a European problem anymore. It's exactly the kind of geopolitical environment that other major powers are actively trying to exploit to redesign the global order.
Which feels like the perfect bridge to what's happening in Beijing right now. Because if anyone is taking notes on a distracted, divided West, it's Xi and Putin sitting down together this week. Now, last week, we spent all that time dissecting Trump's visit to Beijing, and the ink is barely dry on that before Putin shows up.
Yeah, look, the timing is everything here. This is not a coincidence that Putin is shaking hands with Xi literally days after Trump leaves with barely anything to show for it.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell by everything he tweeted out because he made it sound very successful and, you know, very advantageous for Americans. But, you know, he obviously left with very few concrete announcements. But with Putin, they immediately signed this massive slew of agreements on trade, media, and energy, and it feels very intentional, almost like counter-programming.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's pure signaling. Xi is basically saying to the United States, look at the deals I can make with China's actual friends. They didn't name the U.S. directly, but warning about hegemonic countercurrents. That's a quote that came out of the Xi Putin press release, and it's not exactly subtle.
No, it's really not. And this is all happening while the Middle East is essentially on fire. The U.S.-Israeli war with Iran is clearly spooking Beijing right now.
Right, and it's spooking them because of the energy. China runs on imported oil and gas, and the Middle East is their lifeline. So Xi desperately wants a comprehensive ceasefire because a prolonged war threatens to choke off those supply lines.
Which is where Putin sees an opening, right? Because if Middle Eastern crude gets pinched, Russia is standing right there, offering an alternative.
Exactly. Putin literally called their energy sector a locomotive. He's using the chaos in the Middle East to pitch Russia as China's ultimate reliable backup plan.
But it doesn't seem like China is fully buying into that backup plan just yet. I mean, they still haven't greenlit the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline. Moscow has been pushing for that for years.
And I think that's the real tell here. If you weigh China's motives, the most logical assessment isn't that they don't want the gas. It's that they're actively avoiding Europe's mistake of single-source fuel dependency.
I mean, that makes sense. They need energy security, but they don't want Putin holding the keys to their economy.
Right, exactly. And I'd also say right now, China has all the leverage. Russia lost its European market over the Ukraine war, so Beijing has the luxury of dragging its feet to hold out for a rock-bottom price.
It's a really delicate balancing act for Xi. They're propping up Russia's economy enough to keep them afloat, but they're still trying to look like the neutral peacekeeper when it comes to Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly. They keep talking about addressing the root causes of Ukraine and pushing for dialogue. This gives them just enough diplomatic cover on the world stage while they keep buying that super cheap Russian fuel.
Right. Keeping Putin close enough to counter the U.S., but at arm's length so Beijing doesn't get dragged down by his isolation. And we're going to see that play out soon at the APEC summit in November, especially if Trump attends and creates this wild three-way dynamic with Putin and Xi. But while the world watches that bloc form, we just got news that the U.S. is suddenly pausing a $14 billion arms sale to Taiwan, supposedly to save the munitions for the Iran campaign. It feels like a much bigger game being played than just rationing weapons, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the official public line here is all about prioritizing stockpiles for the Middle East, but you have to look at the timing. This pause comes right on the heels of the Beijing summit. And when you strip away the logistics excuse and you look at the broader shifts, it's pretty clear Taiwan is being used as a negotiating chip.
I can't believe you're having to bring that into focus, even though that just happened last week. Xi came out and basically said, don't even try to discuss Taiwanese sovereignty with me because I feel like that's ours. That island is ours. And Trump backed down from Taiwanese sovereignty. Like it shouldn't even be a question, but you're having to bring it back because there's so much going on, I guess, constantly. It's very difficult to keep up with everything. And then obviously there's competing narratives going on. Constantly, it's hard to keep up with what's going on.
It really is. And trying to put an episode together with all those competing public statements and competing narratives, it becomes very difficult for us.
Right. Okay. So let's bring it back. And I mean, it gets me thinking about how much of this is actually about military logistics and how much is pure transactional diplomacy. I mean, they literally called it a negotiating chip just days ago.
Yeah, and look, if we run this through a basic competing hypotheses check, the highest probability is a direct, quiet quid pro quo with Xi.
Meaning Beijing guarantees they won't make a military move on the island during this U.S. administration, as long as Washington holds back the heavy defense support. That has to make Taipei feel incredibly vulnerable. They didn't ask for this.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that that's how they're feeling right now. And they're watching the U.S. bypass decades of established diplomatic norms just to strike a temporary deal. But for China, this is a massive strategic win that buys them crucial time.
Buy them time for what, though? Because the everyday pressure on the Taiwanese people hasn't stopped. It's just shifted gears.
Yeah, I think I want to go back to our discussion from a month ago. In the year 2028, both the U.S. and Taiwan are going to have major elections that year. And Beijing doesn't want a messy, economically devastating war right now if they can avoid it.
So in that conversation, you assessed China is banking on shifting the political landscape from the inside instead. If they can quietly influence the 2028 election to get a more Beijing-friendly government, they don't even need to fire a shot.
Yeah, that political integration is always the preferred route over kinetic conflict. So if Xi secured a non-provocation agreement, it clears the runway for a massive interference campaign over the next couple of years.
Which makes sense when you see Taipei scrambling to ramp up their own domestic defense spending. They know they might be standing alone for a while.
Exactly. And if Washington is openly treating Taiwan as a bargaining chip, it forces us to ask what the administration is actually trying to buy with it.
Does this mean you're officially changing your analysis then? Moving the predicted 2026 or 2027 invasion timeline out to 2028 with maybe no invasion at all if their influence campaign is successful.
Yeah, look, I appreciate you highlighting the shift in analysis because changing an assessment isn't something that we take lightly and it shouldn't be taken lightly. But the overall goal for Xi has not changed. So that part of the assessment is not changing. He still wants Taiwan reintegrated by 2030. So China can become this new superpower, the exact hegemony they rail so hard against with the U.S., which is funny because it's only bad when it's someone else that's doing it. But the old timeline meant that they needed to start an invasion soon. If they were going to get there, they would have to, and if they were going to get there by force, they would have to do it by 2026 or 2027, unless they could manipulate two massive variables, U.S. support for Taiwan and the Taiwan election itself. And all the public information that I'm seeing right now points to China deciding they can actually influence that particular election. Some would say even the U.S. election. But if that doesn't happen, there's this other theory that they just aren't currently prepared to invade. And that if they're not prepared to invade, they're not prepared to defend the island of Taiwan. So this assessment is no doubt going to change over the next couple of years as new intelligence comes in.
Which is exactly what happened right before the Russia invasion of Ukraine. We were having these exact same conversations as the intel shifted, and I think that's what set the stage for a correct prediction ultimately. So if Beijing is shifting to a longer, quieter political game instead of an immediate military one, how does Taiwan even begin to counter that kind of invisible pressure going into next year?
I think it starts in the information space, and that can only be achieved with the help of allies from the West. Right now, those allies are losing the information game. I think that is where Xi has calculated you can actually win in a Taiwan election.
As we've just laid out this week, the era of unconditional alliances is officially behind us. We are now operating in a transactional reality where the defense of European airspace and the sovereignty of Taiwan are being treated as negotiable chips on a much larger board. The stakes of this balancing act are astronomical. If the contradictory narratives surrounding the Iranian nuclear framework collapse, we are instantly back on the precipice of regional war and military strikes. If the phantom threats on the Belarusian border successfully stretch Ukrainian defenses, Moscow will have bought itself the exact window it needs. And as Beijing pivots from kinetic invasion plans to quiet political interference ahead of 2028, Taipei is left vulnerable and isolated. The coming weeks will determine whether these high-stakes diplomatic gambles actually cool the temperature or if they simply embolden adversaries to exploit a distracted, fractured West. We'll be right here all week, tracking every single shift. But before we sign off, is there anything else you would like to discuss?
We're recording on Memorial Day. So for our U.S. listeners, happy Memorial Day. I know you're listening to it after, but it's also a German holiday. So no one's doing any work today.
What did Jesus do?
That is typically the reason why. Right. Let's see.
You don't even know what holiday it is?
No, I just know everything's closed, so I can't do anything.
Oh.
Yeah. It's better that way, though.
Do you mean the restaurants are closed, too?
No, just the old penny store.
Oh. Shucks.
It is Whit Monday.
What does that mean?
It's Pentecost Monday, so you were right. It's the Monday of the Holy Spirit. So once again, you were right.
I mean, it's that's like a meme.
That is what Jesus did.
That's a meme that I've seen several times on my feed, talking about how Germany has a lot of, you know, government holidays where everything closes down, and everybody's question is, well, what did Jesus do now? Like, because it's, right. Yeah. But anyway,
and it just comes like, well, I guess I'm not German, so if we grew up in Germany, we'd probably know all the holidays. But
oh, for sure, we definitely would. Even though I don't think, like, I haven't seen too many people actually go to church though, or anything, on these days. But what are you supposed to do? Are you not? It's not like a church thing. You just stay home and don't grocery shop on those days.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these. So a lot of these holidays were just kept so that people could have days off.
Bless.
And they're like, where I'm at, there's not a ton of people that they're going to church or anything like that. I would say in like the rural areas, they're probably celebrating going to church and things like that. But in the cities,
not
just
in
a day
big
off.
City. All right, Tiana.
No different
up.
from the U.S. in that way.
Right. Right. Anyway, so is that all? That all you got?
That's all I've got. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.